The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the July 8th and 15th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Keiho by Haruki Murakami. I've dated all kinds of women in my life, the man said, but I have to say I've never seen one as ugly as you. This came after they'd had dessert while they were waiting for coffee to be served. It took a moment for his words to sink in. 3, maybe 4 seconds. The statement came out of nowhere, and Keiho couldn't immediately read his intentions. As the man was pronouncing these blunt, alarming words, he was smiling the whole time. A gentle, mostly friendly type of smile. There wasn't even a hint of humor in what he had said. He wasn't making a joke. He was completely serious. The only way that Keiho could think of reacting was to take the napkin from her lap, toss it onto the table, grab her purse from the chair beside her, stand up, and without a word, leave the restaurant. That would, most likely, be the best way to deal with the situation. But somehow, Keiho couldn't. One reason for this, one that occurred to her only later on, was that she was genuinely startled. A second reason was curiosity. She was angry, of course she was. How could she not be? But more than that, she wanted to know what in the world this man was trying to tell her. Was she really that ugly? And was there something beyond this remark? Saying you're the ugliest may be a bit of an overstatement, the man added after a pause. But you are the plainest woman I've seen, no doubt about it. Keiho pursed her lips and silently studied the man's face, her eyes fixed on him. Why did this man feel the need to say something like that? On a blind date, which was sort of was, if you don't like the other person that much, then you can just not get in touch afterward. Simple enough. Why insult her to her face? The man was probably 10 years or so older than Keiho, handsome, his clothes spotless and impeccable. He wasn't exactly Keiho's type, though he'd look like he came from a good family. He had a photogenic face. That might be a more accurate way of putting it. Add a couple of inches to his height, and he could have been an actor. The restaurant he chose, too, was cozy and stylish, the dishes tasty and refined. He wasn't what you would call talkative, but was decent enough at keeping a conversation moving, and there had been no awkward silences. Oddly, though, when she looked back on it later, she couldn't remember what they'd talked about. During dinner, she found herself warming to him. She had to admit it. And then, out of nowhere, this. What was happening here? You might find this strange, she said in a calm voice after 2 espressos had been brought to their table. It was as if he could read Keiho's mind. He dropped a small sugar cube into his espresso and quietly stirred it. Why did I have dinner to the very end with someone I find ugly? Or maybe I should say whose face I don't like. After we'd drunk the first glass of wine, I should have been able to just cut the evening short. It's a complete waste of time, isn't it, to take an hour and a half and eat a 3-course dinner? And why, at the very tail end of the evening, do I have to say something like that? Keiho remained silent, staring at the face of the man across the table. Her hands clutched the napkin in her lap tightly. I think it's because I couldn't stifle my curiosity, the man said. Probably I wanted to know what a really homely woman like you was thinking, how being so homely affects your life. And was your curiosity satisfied? Keiho wondered. Of course, she didn't ask it out loud. And was my curiosity satisfied? The man asked after taking a sip of coffee. There was no mistake here. He could read her thoughts. Like an anteater licking an anthill clean with its long, thin tongue. The man shook his head a fraction and returned his cup to the saucer and answered his own question. No, it wasn't. He raised his hand, called the waiter over, and paid the bill. He turned to Cahoe, bowed slightly, and went straight out of the restaurant. He didn't even look back. Truth be told, since she was little, Cahoe had never been that interested in her looks. The face she saw in the mirror didn't strike her as either beautiful or especially ugly. It didn't disappoint her or make her happy. Her lack of interest in her face stemmed from the fact that she didn't feel that her looks were affecting her life in any way. Or perhaps it was better to say that she'd never had an opportunity to know if they were. She was an only child, and her parents had always showered her with an affection that was likely unconnected to how pretty she might or might not be. Through adolescence, Cahoe remained indifferent to her looks. Most of her girlfriends brooded over their appearance and tried every makeup trick in the book to improve it. But she couldn't understand this urge. She spent very little time in front of the mirror. Her only goal was to keep her body and her face appropriately clean and neat. And that was never a particularly difficult task. She attended a co-ed public high school and had a few boyfriends. If the boys in her class had voted for their favorite female classmate, she would never have won. She wasn't that type. Still, for some reason, in every class she was in, there were always one or two boys who were interested in her and showed it. Cahoe had no clue what it was about her that interested them. Even after she graduated from high school and started attending an art school in Tokyo, she seldom lacked for boyfriends. So there was no need for her to worry about whether she was attractive or not. In that sense, you could say she was lucky. She always found it quite odd that friends who were far better looking than she was agonized over their looks, in some cases undergoing expensive plastic surgery. Cahoe could never fathom this. And so when, a little after her 26th birthday, this man she'd never met before bluntly told her she was ugly, Cahoe was deeply confused. Instead of feeling shock at his words, she was, quite simply, unsettled and bewildered. It was her editor, a woman named Machida, who'd introduced her to the man. Machida worked at a small publishing company in Kanda, mainly putting out books for children. She was 4 years older than Cahoe, had two children herself, and edited the children's books that Cahoe created. Cahoe's picture books didn't sell all that well, but between those and her freelance work doing illustrations for magazines, she made enough to get by. At the time of the date, Cahoe had just broken up with a man her own age whom she'd gone out with for a little over 2 years and was feeling unusually down. The breakup had left a bad taste, and partly because of this, her work wasn't going well. Aware of the situation, Machida set up the blind date for her. It might be just the change of pace you need, she told her. 3 days after Cahoe met the men, Machida called her. So how was the date? She wasted no time in asking. Cahoe gave a vague, skirting a direct answer, and then asked a question of her own. What kind of person is he, anyway? Machida said, honestly, I don't know that much about him. Sort of a friend kind of thing. I think he's near 40, single, and works in investments of some kind. He's from a good background and good at his job. No criminal record as far as I know. I met him once and we talked for a few minutes and I thought he was handsome and seemed pleasant enough. He's a little on the short side, I'll admit. But then Tom Cruise isn't that tall either. Not that I've ever seen Tom Cruise in person. But why would a man so handsome, pleasant, and good at his job have to go to the trouble of going on a blind date? Cahoe asked. Wouldn't he have plenty of women he could go out with? Machida said, I suppose so. He's very sharp, efficient at his job, but I happen to hear that his personality is a little quirky. I decided not to mention that, since I didn't want to prejudice you before you met him. A little quirky, K.O. said, repeating the words. She shook her head. Could you really call that a little quirky? Did you exchange phone numbers? Machida asked. K.O. paused a moment before replying. Exchange phone numbers? No, we didn't, she said finally. 3 days after this, Machida called her again. I'm calling about the handsome Mr. Sahara. Can you talk? She said. Sahara was the name of the man with whom she had had the blind date, pronounced the same way as the desert. K.O. put down her drawing pen and shifted the receiver from her left hand to her right. Sure, go ahead. Last night he called me, Machida said. He said he'd like to see you again and wondered if you two could talk. He sounded pretty serious. K.O. couldn't help but gasp and was silent for a while. He wants to see me again so the two of us can talk? K.O. couldn't believe what she was hearing. K.O.-chan, Machida said, sounding concerned. Are you listening? Yes, I'm listening, K.O. said. He seemed to like you. So what should I tell him? Common sense dictated that she say no. He had, after all, said such horrible things right to her face. Why would she ever need to see that kind of person again? But she couldn't reach a decision at this point. Several doubts converged in her brain, all jumbled together. Can I think about it? She asked Machida. Let me call you back. K.O. ended up seeing Sahara one more time that Saturday afternoon. They arranged to meet during the day for a short time, with no meal or alcohol involved, at a place where they could talk quietly, though there could be other people nearby. These were K.O.'s conditions, which Machida conveyed to him. Odd conditions for a second date, Machida commented. You're being extremely cautious. I suppose, K.O. said. You haven't hidden a wrench in your purse or anything, right? Machida said and laughed happily. That might not be such a bad idea, K.O. thought. The last time they'd met, Sahara had looked as if he were on his way home from work, in a nice dark suit and tie. But this time he had on a casual weekend outfit, a thick brown leather jacket, slim jeans, and well-worn in work boots, sunglasses stuck in his breast pocket. Quite a stylish look. K.O. arrived a little later than the set time, and when she got to the hotel lobby, Sahara was already there, texting someone. When he spotted K.O., a faint smile rose to his lips, and he closed the leather flap on his cell phone cover. There was a motorcycle helmet on the seat beside him. I ride an 1800cc BMW, Sahara said. Of all the BMWs, this one has the highest displacement, and the engine makes the nicest, boldest sound. K.O. didn't say anything. I couldn't care less what you ride, a BMW, a motorcycle, a tricycle, or a ox cart, she silently muttered to herself. I bet you're not at all interested in motorcycles, but I thought I'd mention it anyway. Just FYI, Sahara added. This guy knows how to read my feelings, K.O. thought again. A waitress came over and she ordered coffee. Sahara ordered chamomile tea. By the way, have you ever been to Australia? Sahara asked. K.O. shook her head. She'd never been to Australia. Do you like spiders? Sahara asked, forming a fan in the air with both hands. Arachnids? The kind with eight legs? K.O. didn't reply. She hated spiders more than anything, but wasn't about to reveal that. Sahara said, When I went to Australia, I saw a spider the size of a baseball mitt. Just looking at it gave me the creeps. Made me shudder. But the locals actually welcomed them into their homes. You know why? K.O. remained silent. Because they're nocturnal and they eat cockroaches. They're what you'd call useful, beneficial bugs. Still, imagine having spiders that eat cockroaches. I'm always amazed by how clever and magnificent the structure of the food chain is. The coffee and the herbal tea came, and for a while the two of them sat before their drinks without speaking. I imagine you find it kind of odd, Sahara said after a few minutes, his tone formal, that I wanted to see you again like this. Again, Cahoe didn't respond. She didn't dare to. And I must say, I'm truly surprised that you would agree to see me again, Sahara said. I feel thankful. But I was astonished that you'd agree to it after that rude thing I said. No, what I said went beyond rude. It was an unforgivable insult that tramples on a woman's dignity. When I say that to women, most of them never agree to see me again, which is only to be expected, really. Most of them? Cahoe repeated his words in her mind. That shocked her. Most of them? She said, speaking for the first time. You mean that you've said the same thing to all the women you meet? You're saying... Exactly, Sahara readily admitted. I tell all the women I meet exactly what I said to you. I've never seen anyone as ugly as you. Usually, when we're enjoying dinner and dessert has just been served. With this kind of thing, timing is everything. But why? Cahoe asked, her voice dry. Why do you have to do something like that? I don't get it. You hurt people for no reason? You spend time and money just to insult them? Sahara tilted his head a little and said, Why, that's the real question. It's too complicated to explain. Instead, why don't we talk about the effects such a statement has? What always surprises me is the reaction of the women I say that to. You might think that having those awful words said right to their face, most people would fly into a rage or else laugh it off. And there are people like that. But not that many, really. The majority of women are simply hurt, deeply, and for a long time. In some cases, they blurt out something weird, something hard to comprehend. Silence reigned for a while. After a time, K.O. broke it. And you're saying you enjoy seeing those reactions? No, I don't enjoy it. I just find it strange how when women who are obviously beautiful, or at least well above average, are told to their face that they're ugly, how amazingly flustered or hurt they get. The coffee she hadn't touched, steam rising from it, was steadily growing cold. I think you're sick, Cahoe said firmly. Sahara nodded. I guess so. You're probably right. I might be sick. Not to excuse myself or anything, but in a sick person's eyes, it's the world that's even sicker, right? Listen, nowadays, people severely attack lookism. Most people loudly denounce beauty contests. Say the words ugly woman in public and you'll get beaten up. But check out TV and magazines. They're full of ads for cosmetics, plastic surgery, and spa treatments. No matter how you look at it, it's a ridiculous, meaningless double standard. A farce, really. But that doesn't justify hurting other people for no reason, does it? Cahoe countered. Yes, you're right, Sahara said. I am sick. That's an undeniable fact. But, depending on how you look at it, being sick can also be enjoyable. Sick people have their own special place that only sick people can enjoy, like a Disneyland for the disturbed. And fortunately for me, I have the time and money to enjoy that place. Without a word, Cahoe stood up. Time to put an end to this. She couldn't talk to this man anymore. Hold on a sec, Sahara said to Cahoe as she stood there. Could you give me just a bit more of your time? It won't take long. 5 minutes is enough. I'd like you to stay and hear me out. Cahoe hesitated for a few seconds and then took her seat again. She didn't want to, but there was something in the man's voice she found hard to resist. What I wanted to say to you was that the reaction you had was different from anyone else's, Sahara said. When you were assaulted by those awful words, you didn't panic. Didn't respond in anger, didn't laugh it off, and didn't look so hurt by it. Without letting any of these trite emotions take over, you just gazed at me, as if you were studying some bacteria under a microscope. You're the only one who's ever reacted that way. I was impressed, and I thought, why doesn't this woman feel hurt? If there is something that would deeply wound her, well, then what is it? So you're doing this, Keho said, setting up these elaborate meetings over and over just to see women's reactions? That's it? The man inclined his head. There haven't been all that many, just when the opportunity presents itself. I never use a dating app or anything. Things that are too simple are boring. People I know introduce me, and I meet only women whose backgrounds I know about. Old-fashioned, omiai-type arranged meetings are the best. The old-school approach. I find that exciting. And then you insult the women? Keo said. Sahara didn't respond. He merely gave a smile that soon subsided. He held his hands out in front of his chest, studying them for a while, as if checking whether there had been any changes in the lines in his palms. I was wondering if you'd go riding with me on my motorcycle, he said, looking up. I brought an extra helmet along for you. The weather's good today, and we can enjoy tooling around. I just passed 5,000 kilometers on the odometer, and the horizontally opposed engine BMW so proud of is tuned to perfection. An undeniable rage boiled up inside Cato. It had been some time since she'd felt this angry. Or perhaps it was the first time ever. We can enjoy tooling around? What the hell was he thinking? I'll pass, Keo said, keeping her emotions under wraps, her voice as calm as she could manage. Do you know the number one thing I want to do right now? Sahara shook his head. What would that be? To put some distance between me and you, even a little distance, and scrub off this filth that's on me. I see, Sahara said. Indeed. Well, I guess I'll have to unfortunately give up on tooling around this time. But what do you think? You think wanting to get some distance from me will work out? What does that mean? Somewhere a baby cried. The man glanced in that direction and then looked right at K.O. Before long, I think you'll understand, he said. Once I'm interested in people, I don't let them go that easily. And you might find this surprising, but in terms of distance, we're not that far apart, you and I. See, people can't escape the structure of the chain. No matter how much they don't want to see it, even if they want to have nothing to do with it, swallowing something and being swallowed are two sides of the same coin, front and back, credit and debit. That's the way the world is. We will probably, I think, meet again somewhere. I should never have seen this man again, Keo thought. She was sure of this as she strode quickly toward the exit. When Machida called me that time, I should have made that clear. No thanks, I should have said. I never want to see that person again. It was curiosity. Curiosity that led me here. I think I wanted to find out what in the world this man was aiming at, what he wanted. I think I wanted to know that, but that was a mistake. He used curiosity as the bait to skillfully lure me in, just as a spider would. A chill ran up her spine. I want to go somewhere warm, she thought. The desire couldn't be stronger. A southern island with a white beach. Lie down there, close my eyes, shut off my mind, and let the sunlight wash over me. Several weeks went by. Keo, of course, wanted to drive any thoughts of that man Sahara from her mind as soon as she could. Shove this pointless episode, one that had nothing to do with her life, somewhere she'd never see it again. And yet, as she worked at her desk at night, the man's face suddenly, unexpectedly rose up in her mind, smiling faintly, gazing, for no particular reason, at his long, delicate fingers. She started spending more time in front of the mirror, much more than she ever had. She'd stand in front of the bathroom mirror, carefully checking every detail of her face, as if reconfirming who she was. And it occurred to her that she wasn't much interested in any of it. This was definitely her face, yet she could find nothing that dictated that it had to be her face. She even started to envy her friends who'd had plastic surgery. They knew, or at least believed they knew, which part of their face, surgically altered, would make them more beautiful, more satisfied with their looks. My own life may be taking a clever revenge on me. She couldn't help thinking this. When the right time comes, my life may simply take away what I owe, credit and debit. Kehoe understood that if she'd never met that guy, Sahara, she never would have thought this way. He may have been patiently waiting for the longest time for me to show up in front of him, she thought, like an enormous spider waiting for its prey in the dark. Occasionally, a large motorcycle would speed by on the street outside her apartment late at night when everyone was asleep. Whenever she heard the low, dry throbbing, the drumbeat of the engine, her body trembled ever so slightly. Her breathing grew ragged, and cold sweat oozed from her armpits. "I brought along an extra helmet for you," the man had said. She pictured herself riding on the back of that BMW motorcycle, and she imagined where that powerful machine would take her. What kind of place would it take me to? "In terms of distance, we're not that far apart, you and I," the man had said. 6 months after that strange blind date, Kehoe wrote a new children's book. One night, she was dreaming she was at the bottom of a deep sea, and when she woke up, she felt as if she were suddenly being tossed to the surface, floating up from the sea bottom. She went right to her desk and wrote the story. It did not take long to finish. The story was about a girl who goes in search of her face. At a certain point, the girl had lost her face. Someone had stolen it while she was asleep, so she had to do something to get it back. But she couldn't remember at all what her face had looked like. She didn't even know if it was beautiful or ugly, round or thin. She asked her parents, her siblings, but for some reason no one could recall what sort of face it was, or else no one was willing to tell her. So the girl decided to set out alone on a face-seeking journey. For the time being, she found a face that would fit her and pasted it on where her own face should be. Without a face of some kind, people she met along the way would find her strange. The girl walked all over the world, climbed high mountains, crossed deep rivers, walked across vast deserts, managed to make her way through savage jungles. She was sure that if she came across her face, she'd recognize it right away. "Since this is a very important part of my existence," she told herself. As she traveled, she met many people and had all kinds of odd experiences. She was nearly trampled by a herd of elephants, was attacked by a huge black spider, was almost kicked by wild horses. A long time passed as she walked everywhere, examining countless faces as she went. Yet she never found her own face. What she saw were always the faces of others. She didn't know what to do. And before she knew it, she was no longer a girl, but an adult woman. Would she never be able to find her own face again? She fell into despair. As she was sitting at the tip of a cape in a northern land, crying in utter hopelessness, a tall young man in a fur coat appeared and sat down beside her. His long hair gently waved in the wind from the sea. The young man gazed into her face and, smiling broadly, said this, "I've never seen a woman with such a lovely face as yours." By then, the face she'd pasted on had become her true face. All sorts of experiences, all kinds of emotions and thoughts had joined together to create her face. This was her face, and her face alone. She and the young man were married and lived happily in this northern land. For some reason, and Kehoe herself wasn't at all sure why, this book seemed to spark something in the hearts of children, especially girls in their early teens. These young readers excitedly followed the girl's adventures and trials as she set off into the wide world in search of her face. And when, in the end, The girl found her face and discovered inner peace. Readers breathed a sigh of relief. The writing was simple. Cahoe's illustrations, symbolic, monochrome line drawings. And that tale, the work of writing and illustrating it, brought a kind of emotional healing to Cahoe as well. I can live in this world as me, just as I am, she realized. There's nothing to fear. The dream she'd seen at the bottom of the sea had taught her that. The anxiety she'd felt in the middle of the night grew fainter, though she couldn't say it was gone completely. The book sold steadily through word of mouth and got a good review in a newspaper, but Cheetah was thrilled. I'm thinking this children's book may become a long-term bestseller. I just get that feeling, Machida said. It's a completely different style from your other books, which surprised me at first. But I wonder, where did you get the idea for it? After thinking about it for a moment, Cahoe replied, in a very dark, deep place, she said. The next story is a piece of fiction also from the July 8th and 15th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. It's a story recently discovered by E.L. Doctorow. The story was written in the mid-1950s after E.L. Doctorow, then as in his 20s, had completed his military service in Germany. It was found by the biographer Bruce Weber with Doctorow's papers at the Fales Library and Special Collections at New York University. And now, The Drummer Boy on Independence Day by E.L. Doctorow. In our town, as in most, we celebrated the 4th of July with a parade around the square and a few speeches from the steps of City Hall. An indispensable part of that ceremony, of course, was the Civil War veteran. And at the time I'm telling about, we still had one. A Confederate, naturally, an old man of bone and leather named John Suetti. John had been a drummer boy with T.J. Jackson and was thought to have seen most of what happened in the Shenandoah Valley. But he never spoke about his experiences, and he must have been 102 years old before he finally agreed to lead an Independence Day parade. The year he accepted the invitation, the parade committee, which had offered it to him by custom, nearly swallowed its collective cigar. John usually turned callers from his door, and by his own custom he had refused for decades to have anything to do with the holiday. The fact is, he wasn't an easy subject for town pride, in the first place when, on each birthday, he was asked to what he attributed his long life. He always said his genes. In the second, he was known to hate children. And in the third, he was so old that his wrinkles had smoothed out again and he had the face of a beautiful, toothless girl. Or maybe it was his clouded, angry eyes or his small head tucked in the shadow of a humped shoulder that made him inaccessible. The only person to whom he ever talked willingly was his daughter, a 70-year-old maiden who cared for him in a peeling wooden house near the center of town. In the early mornings, she used to sit him on the brown front porch, hung with a broken trellis and edged with weeds and wildflowers, so he could watch the sun the first half of the day. At noon, after his nap, she'd walk him around to the back and sit him down there. He'd wait for the sun to come over the roof and then follow it down past the railroad yard and the ball-bearing factory until, finally, it disappeared. No one could tell the clock by him. No one could quote an epigram of his. No one could ever remember his being a friend of their daddy, or even their granddaddy. I don't know whether you'd remember the Civil War veterans in your own parades. They usually rode in an open car, didn't they? Gazing blankly from behind their hats and medals like monkeys dressed up to look cute. I guess the old man knew the impression he wanted to make. He agreed to the parade only on the condition that he could walk, and only if he didn't have to wear his uniform. There was some objection, of course. Lindsey Grayson, the head of our American Legion, swore he doubted that the old man was a veteran after all, since what veteran wouldn't wear his uniform? There was even talk of importing someone from the other end of Caldwell County. A man was said to live there who had really fought, not just drummed, and who had a letter of commendation signed by Longstreet. But the talk died soon. We are people sunk in propriety, however we struggle. And when the fourth came around, it was John Cewetti who led the parade. I'll never forget the sight. John was almost too old to stand up, let alone march. And his maiden daughter had to hold his elbow while he stepped slowly up the middle of the street, followed by the mayor, the firemen's band, the Daughters of the Confederacy, and the rest. Nobody could march at that pace, and pretty soon the band couldn't keep its beat while it shuffled so. So it stopped playing then. And before long, the whole parade squashed together and became an embarrassed, overdressed clump of people herding along behind this old man, like disciples following a Greek philosopher. Lindsey Grayson was fit to be tied. But old John had the parade, and the whole town, for that matter. He wouldn't give it up even when he finally reached the city hall steps. He didn't climb the whitewashed speaker's platform, but stood off to the side and turned round, facing the embarrassed confusion in back of him. By then, things were so out of their arrangement that everyone just stopped. And with him looking, half blind but stalwart, straight ahead of him, there was nothing for anyone to do but scuff a bit and grow quiet. The tuba player slipped his big bell off his shoulder, and the honor guard leaned on their flagstaffs. In the back of the crowd, there were still some boys and girls laughing and skittish, but John began to talk, that way old people talk, without dreaming that anybody might not be prepared to listen. I've often told the story of what happened that day, and each time in the telling, I see John Cewetti standing in the middle of that trapped, crumpled parade of people, as if he should have been wearing a sheet and sandals, the way those walking saints of India do, or holding a staff and carrying two stone tablets under his arm. He didn't belong in our town that hot morning, or rather, he didn't seem to belong there. It was almost a noon sun above us, and there was just a shiver of a breeze, not enough to stir the big flags on the empty speaker's platform, just enough to flap the little Confederate flags attached to the fenders of cars parked around the square. Every store was closed but for the Walgreens next to Mayor Cole's Buick agency, and across the green, spectators were stooping under the wooden cordons and scurrying over to mingle with the marchers. John piped out his words on the breaths he took between phrases. I doubt if more than the first few in the crowd could hear John or understand him, toothless as he was, but the whole town listened. At Manassas, he said, we waited reserve for 6 hours, and then we got called up to the line. And marching up, we passed the field surgery. I drummed by a hill of arms and legs, cut off and piled higher than I was. Next to John, his daughter stood shyly, holding his elbow. She looked more like his mother than his daughter, slack-bosomed in a black dress and smiling apologetically at no one in particular, as if she had heard these words 1,000 times in the dim, damp must of their house and felt foolish about his bringing them out into the sun. Close on that, he went on. Ezekiel Shuford to the left of me spin and fall with a ball in his neck. He bloodied at the mouth, and I tried to close the hole with my hand or to pluck at the ball, but he died first. Right then I went down to a creek and took my sticks and broke them and threw them in the creek. And I stepped in my drum and threw it in. And then I washed my hands of the blood, and then I walked on home. Now, Jeb Stuart was a fool. He believed we were in glory. Now, Mr. Lee, He didn't make that mistake Jeb Stuart made. You all make. He knew a man had to fight sometimes, but he knew it weren't nothing to drum about. John smacked his lips a few times and looked as if he had more to say. But he lurched forward suddenly, and his smiling, squinting daughter took a firmer hold on his arm, and they moved into the crowd. Everyone fell back, and only when he passed them did people look at one another and begin to speak, and he was already at the sparse edge of the crowd before Lindsey Grayson, who was parade chairman, and the mayor conferred quickly and tried to save the day for tradition. A minute later, a police car pulled out from across the square and drove around alongside John. Ed Rainey, the police chief, tipped his hat and offered to drive the old man to his house. John shook his head, but his daughter nodded, thinking probably her father looked flushed and overtired. So Ed and one of his patrolmen picked John up and put him in the car and helped the daughter in. The doors closed, and a moment later, John Cewetti was gone from the square. After that, Lindsey Grayson and the mayor and the high school principal and Mrs. Cox, the head of the local United Daughters, got up on the speaker's platform, and the band fell in, and the ceremonies got going. Things weren't right, though. The microphone was troublesome and kicked back a hum. The sun was hot, and after the band played the anthem and Dixie, a lot of cars pulled out of the square and kids wandered off down the streets. The counter boy at Walgreens had to stop watching things because people were already coming into the store for a cherry smash. The afternoons of most holidays are depressing, and that July 4th afternoon was as disquieting as any. The square was hot and littered and empty, and people stayed in their houses after the mealtime, mapping or fanning themselves. Everyone in town must have heard one version or another of John Cewetti's speech by lunchtime. But if there was any consensus of opinion, it was slow forming. Only after 6 o'clock, when the sun's edge had worn off and Joe Holler was able to open up his tavern by special county dispensation, were the town's regulars able to get together gracefully and ask one another what their opinion should be. By 8 o'clock, the square was coming to life again. Men taking their families out for a ride on the highway stopped in front of Joe's, left their engines idling and their doors open, and went in for a quick beer to hear what was being said. By 9 o'clock, a majority opinion had crystallized, and by midnight, when Fred Warren, the freight dispatcher, went on shift down at the depot, he carried the opinion with him for the ear of any train man who would pass through. Considering old John's silence and solitude for so many decades, considering that he'd never given anyone much chance to make of him a parade doll, I suppose there was a certain appeal to the idea that his speech in the morning had been a confession of an 80-year-old desertion. Of course, not everybody got as self-righteous about it as Lindsey Grayson, beefy and red with beer. Lindsey harangued well into July 5th about how it was a long-standing mystery cleared up, why the old man never talked of the war between the states or wore his grays. He even cornered me at my office late in the evening and told me to do an editorial on the shame of our town. I got away from him only when Mrs. Grayson marched in and took him home. But if not everybody was as militant as Lindsey, they still pretty well agreed with him. Reverend Harper, the Methodist preacher, spoke in church the next Sunday about charity and forgiveness and why we shouldn't always judge a boy by a man's standards. I did what I could for what I thought was right. I printed John Cewetti's speech just as I took it down when he made it. And in the same issue, I ran an editorial on what I believed it signified. But if one man agreed with me, he never let me know. I suppose I have yet to learn how to make my points in this county where I was born. John himself never read a newspaper. And if he was aware at all of how he shifted a few sands under us that day, he never let on. Every morning through the summer, he came out on that small shade porch of his, and every noon after his nap, he went around and back. Then, in October, he died, and that was the end of our drummer boy. A great grandson of his came up from Charlotte and handled the details, and then took John's old daughter back with him to Charlotte. There was nobody at the cemetery but the three of us, though I doubt that the old man would have cared. The following July 4th, the parade committee came up with that veteran from Caldwell County, and they rode him, uniformed, in an open car with the mayor and Lindsey Grayson. I covered the parade, of course. I always like to report on Independence Day in our town. Next, why the French far right triumphed. An expert on French politics explains where President Emmanuel Macron went wrong in calling a snap election, by Isaac Chotiner, on the July 1st, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker. On Sunday, France voted in the first round of its National Assembly elections, which were called by President Emmanuel Macron earlier this month, 3 years before they were scheduled. The result was that the far-right National Rally, the party of the former presidential candidate Marine Le Pen, scored approximately 34% of the vote, followed by an alliance of left parties with around 28% of the vote, and Macron's centrist coalition in third place with 21% of the vote. The specific seat-by-seat results are not yet known, but the far right appears to be on the verge of either a legislative majority, which would mean the National Rally would likely get to choose the next prime minister, or a hung parliament with the far right in control of the most seats. The second and final round of the election, consisting of runoffs in individual constituencies, will take place on July 7th. Macron's shocking decision to call the vote, the first snap election since 1997, came immediately after the far right exceeded expectations in European parliamentary elections and was intended to blunt the far right's rise, which Macron has deemed a threat to the future of France. Macron insisted the French come out to vote, and indeed they did. Turnout was almost 1.5 times as high as during the last National Assembly election, but the results merely showed the far right's strength. To discuss the results, I spoke by phone with Cécile Aldouy, a professor of French studies at Stanford and a specialist on the French far right. During our conversation, which has been edited for length and clarity, we discussed why Macron took such a huge gamble, how the relationship of the French people to the far right has changed in the past decade, and whether the center and left can unite on July 7th and in the future. What is your main takeaway from the first round results? Macron made this huge gamble that a snap election could restore a majority for his coalition and that the opposition would not have time to prepare and rally their own troops, and he has lost his gamble. But actually, the unequivocal lesson is that Macron's alliance has taken a huge hit. They could lose almost 200 seats. This is huge, and the only reason that there was this election is that so Macron decided to have it. And then there is the fact that the turnout was tremendous, which means that the results that we get in percentage points correlate to extremely high numbers of people voting. And so the 34% for the National Rally, which is in and of itself unprecedented, corresponds to about 12 million individuals casting a vote for the National Rally. That's staggering. Macron had essentially said when he called the snap election that this was a hinge moment for the future of the French Republic and that people needed to show up. And so I think there was some hope that if turnout was this high, it would mean that voters had come out to reject the far right. Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to say. The expectation was that turnout would be much higher than in 2022, the last time we also had elections for the National Assembly, and people thought this would mean that people were mobilizing against the far right. But actually, what happened is everyone mobilized their troops. So the far right managed to gather even more momentum than 3 weeks ago. during the European parliamentary elections and gain in numbers of votes and percentage points and in millions of people going to cast a ballot for them. For a long time, political scientists and commentators were of the opinion that a large part of the reason people voted for the far right was to express their protest against the establishment. It was a quiet anger and frustration. So it was a choice by default. But you can't say that anymore. Many people believe in what the National Rally is proposing, and they're gathering toward it. It is in favor of a specific agenda. So I think it's mind-blowing in terms of not just the results, but what it means in the change in the French population and what they view as desirable for the future of France, honestly. Question. I can imagine American readers saying that 34% doesn't seem like that much. Donald Trump won 47% of the vote in 2020. But it does seem, at least from my limited knowledge of France, that given the multi-party nature of the system, parties will often advance to the second round in presidential elections with votes in the 20s. So 34% is incredible. Tremendous, yeah. Even very established governing parties like the French Republican Party or the Socialist Party 15 years ago, if they got 30% in the first round, they would have to be so happy. These are the center-right and center-left parties, respectively, right? The sort of traditional center-right and center-left parties, which have really fallen since then. Yes, and that was a huge victory because we are in a two-round system. It's not a bipolar model as in the U.S. You have a number of candidates. That means that the votes are dispersed around in the first round. In the second round, you could still have two or three or sometimes even four candidates. But this is where you're going to win that seat. And to come to the second round with so much momentum is mind-blowing. So why did Macron do this? Well, there are the official reasons, then there are the electoral reasons, and then there are the psychological reasons. I think the official reason was, okay, the European election showed a strong rejection of the president's coalition, which landed at 14%, which is abysmal, and there was this risk that the current government would not be able to pass new laws because they don't have an absolute majority in Congress. And so they had to force through retirement reform and immigration reform, and it was becoming really difficult to pass legislation and therefore have any concrete action in government. So he wanted to reshuffle everything and have voters face the responsibilities of deciding what direction they wanted the country to go toward. The electoral reason was that the snap election was so quickly organized. It's the shortest campaign in France since 1958. 3 weeks to organize administratively, officially, make alliances, find candidates, etc. And the calculus was that the majority parties were already very organized and united. The left was in shambles and divided, and the National Rally is not very organized and would not be able to make any alliance because they had been ostracized for so long. But the left organized in 4 days and created this new coalition, and the National Rally managed to find allies in the ranks of the Republican Party, and that changed the entire outcome. And the third reason for the snap election, and it's not me psychologizing Macron, but reports from how the decision was made and from insiders, is that he has always wanted to present himself as the phase savior against the risk of Marine Le Pen in the presidential election, the savior when COVID-19 hit France, and he decided there was a war against COVID, the savior of the political system in 2017, and a disruptor. And so his attitude of being the person that can change history, disrupt history, and save it from itself has been his own personal narrative, his own storytelling. And he started to feel he did not have any more room to maneuver, to act, to be the proactive president who writes history because of this kind of relative majority he had. And he wanted to reshuffle the thing and create something historical. I think the result is not exactly what he had in mind, but there is a psychological element of someone who is imbued by a sense of his own might and power to change the history. And he did not consult with many people. This was a very solitary decision. So there is the psychological element of a personality who's very narcissistic in the way he exerts power with little counsel from others. Very little desire to consult different branches of government, for instance, like the leader of the Senate, as he was supposed to do, according to the Constitution. With respect to the Republicans, the center-right party, there had been some tension within their ranks about whether they would be willing to form an alliance with the far right. Where are they today, and do their voters matter for the final round? The French Republican Party has effectively split because of this election. The head of the party had decided to do the alliance with the National Rally and has been ousted from the party. However, the base and the voters, depending on where you live in France, had already been almost interchangeable, had already thought that the National Rally and the Republicans were interchangeable. So there's a huge porosity of the electorate already. So the fact that the heads of the party are in conflict right now about what direction to go doesn't mean much in terms of voters, because locally voters have already started to vote either National Rally or Republicans, depending on the elections and the candidates in front of them. I think the most important thing to understand is that everyone who didn't vote for the National Rally tonight is appalled, afraid, angry, in tears, and there is this huge sense of urgency and the sense of historical turning point that could lead to the worst. The platform of the National Rally would undermine French democracy as we know it, and even the Constitutional Council, the equivalent of the Supreme Court, has already said the main measure in their platform is anti-constitutional. And what measure is this? It's a national preference that would attribute jobs, lodging, welfare, a number of different state-funded fellowships to French nationals, and at the same time reduce who can become French to only people who have so-called French blood in their veins. So a racial definition of citizenship. It's really a historical turning point. Macron's agenda in 2017 was to create a central movement that would be quote-unquote both right and left. And the objective was to undermine the traditional left parties and the traditional right parties to create a huge center that would govern in a more pragmatic, friendly way and avoid division. What this has created is what he had planned, which is it has completely sabotaged the traditional right and left, and they have almost disappeared. As if the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in the U.S. disappeared tomorrow. And instead, it has fueled the National Rally because of a politics that has been business-friendly, but also not very friendly to the employed or to rural areas. It has undermined public services, so it has created a huge resentment among a widening segment of the population. And since the other parties are now in trouble, the only place to turn to, if you're not Macron, or in favor of his politics, is the National Rally. We're out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.